Is she here?
Yes.
Oh, good. You ready to introduce?
Yes.
Sam?
Yes.
She, good.
All right, so we wrote a little, okay, yeah. Wrote a little blurb about Sam and Jordan and their mentor. All right, during our first meeting, Sam, he referred to me as Jedi Master to his Padawan, and we continued that weird relationship throughout our discussions. He asked me what is literary fiction, and I was like, I have no idea. And I'm pretty sure that no one here can provide a cohesive, good definition of that. He spent a lot of time this semester planning out Westerns. He drew inspiration from 310 to Yuma, The Hateful Eight, Lord of the Rings trilogy, I know it's not a Western, Game of Thrones and True Grit. And so hopefully you'll see some of that in the piece that he's going to be reading from today. He plans eventually to move west and write screenplays. And he knows he can deal with Hollywood audiences because he's used to reading Psalms in front of seven-year-olds and old men. And they're like a lot harder of audiences, steelier. So he doesn't really know exactly what he wants to be when he grows up like the rest of us. But there are two things for certain. In Sam, these still waters run deep. And he adults pretty well because he already owns a yellow Dyson vacuum cleaner. All right. Welcome, Sam Martins.
All right. I'll be reading chapter 3 from my 6-chapter novella of a Western. Chapter 3. I will serve dinner after you bury the calf, Rebecca announced. She stood beside a rough-hewn wood table in the side yard of the cabin. She placed a large iron pot on the table. It's been there for 2 days already, on the far side of the fence. She gestured towards the barn, with the wooden ladle in her hand. The men winced from the hunger pains in their stomachs. It had been nearly a week since they had a hot meal. On this last run, they lived on cold biscuits. The stew in the pot smelled enticing, but the aroma was mingled with the decidedly foul odor. Josiah gazed into Rebecca's eyes, seeing if he could break her. She wouldn't budge. She and her ladle stood firm. She's serious. Earl, get your horse and we'll put the calf on a pallet. Meet us out back. Bruce, Junior, and I will bury it. Josiah turned and headed towards the corral. Junior, get on out here, boy, he called, and fetch 2 shovels. As he walked, Josiah studied the horizon. The sky was clear and blue in the late afternoon sun, but dark clouds blanketed the distant mountains. The base of the mountains was no more than 20 miles off, so if rain were coming, it'd be here before morning. Josiah approached the far end of the corral. His nose met a unique blend of cow carcass coupled with horse dung and dust. His nose twitched, and he quickened his pace. As a young boy, Josiah and his father had often buried dead animals they'd come upon in the wild, so while he recognized the stench, he never got used to it. He wondered what had killed the calf and why it had returned for its prey. Perhaps it had been a mountain lion. He'd seen a few of those lately. Hearing steps behind him, Josiah turned to see that Bruce had come to join him. Bruce, nearing 40, stood at eye level with Josiah. They had been friends since childhood and had gone through the 4th grade at the old schoolhouse in Deadwood, the small town about 7 miles north of the ranch. Bruce's family hailed from Junction, a small settlement where the river split, about 6 miles on the south side of Deadwood. They'd met at the school, where Bruce had been good at math, and Josiah had been good at making trouble. Bruce was like an uncle to Junior, and the closest thing Josiah had to a brother. A fine time to bury a cow. Just before we eat, Bruce spoke with a smile. Bruce constantly bore a smile. In the heat of a fight, during a tedious rainstorm, or during a long day's ride, Bruce found good in almost everything. Nothing seemed to bother him, but that didn't mean he was easygoing. He lived by his own code of honor, and after nearly 35 years, Josiah still wondered what the rules were. Hopefully those clouds hold. Bruce, we have a long ride tomorrow, and I don't want to make it in the mud, Josiah said as the two stared down at the dead calf. Rain will dampen spirits, but the men will be ready, Bruce replied, once they've eaten. Bruce stood tall and strong. He had a deeply tanned face bordered by a ragged beard. His unruly black hair had been invaded by gray strands. The calf was covered with a blanket of black flies and small white worms. Upon close inspection, Josiah noticed a neat slit in the center of the torso that could only have come from a mountain lion. He shivered, thinking of Junior, Rebecca, and his mother. They were alone on the ranch for days and weeks at a time. The dangers were real here in the territory. Rattlesnakes and copperheads were the most immediate worry, but mountain lions and coyotes roamed the area at night. Whatever killed this calf would be back, Josiah thought. Earl approached, leading his horse with one hand and carrying a leather pallet in the other. Junior followed behind him with a shovel in each hand. Earl placed the pallet next to the carcass. Josiah and Bruce each took a shovel and slid them under the body. The calf was small but heavy, and they grunted as they lifted it onto the pallet. When the motion of the lift disturbed the flies, they danced around the carcass in a frantic aerial display. Junior covered his nose. Earl attached the straps of the pallet to his horse's saddle, and the four of them began to walk further away from the cabin, looking for a suitable grave site. They walked about 100 more yards, then stopped by a small rut in the terrain. "This'll do," said Josiah. "How deep do we have to dig?" Junior asked. "Enough to cover it completely, and then some," said Josiah. He stuck his shovel into the hard soil, making a rough scraping noise. "Let's get this over with before the sun sets. Supper's waiting," said Bruce. Rebecca watched the cabin window and smiled to herself.
Okay, thank you. Several of our mentors couldn't make it, and I'll be reading their introductions. And this is the introduction for Allison Ekman, written by Meredith Jeffers. Allison Ekman began writing creative nonfiction her senior year at West Virginia University. Since then, she has taken every opportunity to practice, learn, and experiment with her writing, trying out new structures and developing her lyrical language. Her voice has grown clear and confident over the semester. Allison's essays in her capstone collection explore both the complex bonds between sisters and her role as a hiking leader grappling with the unpredictability of nature. Please welcome Allison.
Okay, so the first that I'll be reading is about my experience with like the birth of my eldest younger sister, Lily. So here it is. Lily was born on a human night. Mom and I had been taking a bath when her water broke. During bath time, my mother's back was a canvas on which I'd paint soapy messages. I drew frothy hearts and traced the letters of my name in her musk-scented body wash. Her freckles dotted my paintings. We sat facing each other when it happened. I was absorbed in playing with my bath toys when Mom yelled for Dad the three classic words, "My water broke." I'd been anticipating this moment. For months, I cupped my three-year-old hands around Mom's belly, relaying messages from the outside world that baby would soon be joining. I jumped from my cross-legged position, bubbles flying from my bony body. "We're gonna have a baby." Mom squeezed into a red t-shirt and overalls. She moved her swollen, 5'0 body with care. It was October. We were living in Bermuda, where my 22-year-old dad had taken a job at a satellite tracking station. We lived in a green and white house, the Wellesley Lodge on Duke of York Street, a building that contained four apartments. An Indian family occupied one of the ground units and us the other. Our side had a porch that faced the ocean. The colorful houses of St. George sloped down from the Wellesley Lodge towards the dockyard. The lodge, over 140 years old, sat about a mile from the hustle and bustle of cruise ships that came and went. In the mornings, we heard their horns saluting other vessels and leaving port. The apartment was bright. Sunlight flooded into the rooms and bounced off the white walls and ceramic floors. But it was almost bedtime when Mom's water broke. The night was blue-black behind our windows. I danced around the apartment as Mom and Dad made phone calls and grabbed the last-minute toothbrush and change of clothes to take to the hospital. "We're gonna have a baby, we're gonna have a baby," I sang in a sing-song voice, running around my parents' legs and jumping on the couch. Caroline and Scott, Dad's work friends, watched me while my parents were at the hospital. Caroline was tall, with rosy cheeks and blonde hair. Scott had a brown beard that looked like my dad's. Both their smiles were the kind that reached their eyes. Caroline snapped a picture of me and my parents before they left. The three of us smiled at the disposable camera with the same blue eyes and honey brown hair. I was unaware that my family dynamic would be changed for the always, clueless of the ferocity with which you can love and hate a little sister. Lily's labor lasted 18 hours. The next day, I played Jenga with Caroline and Scott at their wooden kitchen table. They gave me bugles to eat. I put the traffic cone-shaped chips onto each of my fingers, pretending they were claws or the long acrylic nails that women sometimes wore. Later, finding myself temporarily alone, I grabbed a box of toothpicks off the kitchen table. I walked around the living room and kitchen, sticking the little wooden spears in every electrical outlet I could find. When Caroline caught me, she snatched the box from my hands. "Honey, no," she said, squatting next to me and plucking the toothpicks from the outlet. Soon, plastic electrical plugs appeared. That evening, Dad picked me up and drove us to the hospital. We got out of our little red Suzuki with the steering wheel on the right side and no seat belts. Dad handed me a brown teddy bear with a plaid bow tie. "This is for you," he said. "It's a present from the baby." I took the bear and looked into its round black eyes. It was adorable, but I called Dad's bluff. That baby never would have been able to buy me a bear herself. Dad was already trying to get me on the baby's good side, but she'd have to win my approval for herself. I stayed quiet as we walked through the thick air towards the hospital, our feet slapping the wet macadam. Meeting Lily was anticlimactic. I climbed up onto the hospital bed with Mom. Dad put the tiny baby in my arms. She looked like every other baby I'd seen, other than her huge blue eyes. "I like Lily," I said, except I said Willie instead of Lily. We brought the alien baby home. I was no longer the center of the universe. If my parents were satellites, they found a new object around which they centered their orbit. I took to excreting in odd places of the house, between couch cushions and my Aladdin-themed jewelry box. I once cried to my mother about a bad dream in which I had tossed baby Lily in a trash can and closed the lid. Our days in the Wellesley Lodge were numbered. The tracking station in Bermuda was being phased out. After 2 years on the island, we returned home to the States with many fresh freckles and a new baby to boot. And I'm going to be reading another part of this story later on. We moved around while I was a kid, but we eventually made it back to Lancaster, where we're from. And so this was my first day in our new neighborhood. On the day we moved in, I met Casey, a Catholic girl who lived behind my house. She was one of the middle children in a family of 12. A family of 12. The sheer possibility of having 9 siblings rattled my mind. We swung at the neighborhood park as she interrogated me, the fresh meat, the new kid on the block. "What do you like to do for fun?" "I like to read. I love Harry Potter." "So you're kind of a nerd?" She wore basketball shorts that I'd only see boys wear. Her brown hair was pulled into a ponytail and her cheeks were tanned. "What school do you go to?" I asked, hoping it wasn't mine. "We're all homeschooled," she answered. Her facial expression said, "Dare me." "Are you religious?" She stood on the swing and pushed her hips back and forth to generate momentum. By this time, other neighborhood kids had flocked to the park. They'd heard there was a new girl moving in. I knew from the tone of Casey's voice what my answer should be, and my family did go to church outside of D.C. Probably not Casey's kind of church, though. "Yes," I answered assuredly. "We're Unitarian Universalists." The neighborhood kids stared at me. A tall girl with long, straight hair clarified, "Are you a Christian?" I figured Christianity couldn't be all that different, although I couldn't see these kids holding hands, swaying, or singing Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind. "Yep, UU is a sect," I said. The kid said, oh, and registered me as okay, but different. I needed to make an escape quick before I was asked other questions I didn't have the right answers to. "My parents need help unpacking," I said. I walked to our new home, my brown sandals feeling too tight in the neighborhood's abundance of grass.
All right, next up is Jordan Carter and her mentor, Nat Updike. Sorry, I forgot to introduce you last time.
All right. Jordan once told me that Mark Brazidis referred to her work as prose poetry, and at first she thought that was a dirty word. She realized, though, throughout her years here that this was actually high praise, and she's now proud of the images she can create in her writing. She's going to be reading from Jesus at Junk Drawer, her capstone piece. Her works appeared in Calliope in the Machilla Review, where Ellen Hopkins was a guest judge, and in Water Soup Press. She'll graduate summa cum laude this May. She was named one of WVU's outstanding seniors, and she plans to pursue an MFA in fiction within the next year. But Jordan's more than just her accolades. She's a writer not afraid of tackling issues like abuse, drug use, prostitution, child neglect, etc. Her work searches for the humanity in the degraded, the forgotten, and the untouched. She could not have written this piece without her boyfriend Mark, who helped her develop movement and consistency of voice, or without her friend Christopher, who tolerated and welcomed questions like, "What does it smell like after rain?" and who challenged her to create writing that served Arnie, the protagonist of her piece, rather than Arnie serving her writing. Lastly, her cat Cinder, who was, in her words, resistant to the writing process, chewing on pencils, lying on laptops, and generally doing cat things. Cinder will be happy to know that it's over for the time being, and Jordan can go back to being a cat mom. So please welcome Jordan Carter.
Thank you, Nat. I'm going to start with one of my earlier vignettes. It's called Worms. After 3 days of rain, the sun is out and steam is coming off the pavement. I want to ask Mom if I can go outside, but I can't find her, so I go out anyway. It's nice out here after being inside for so long. It's a little cool, and the bugs are quiet, and the air feels clean on my skin. In the yard, the anthills are padded down, and there are raindrops on blades of grass. I play in the puddles on the plastic truck bed cover until I get bored and kick it over. I gasp when I see the wriggly, slimy, shiny words, worms, underneath. We learned about worms in school, about how they eat the dirt and push themselves around with muscles, like squeezing a tube of toothpaste. We keep some in a jar full of dirt at school that came from teacher. How did they get here? Why aren't they in the dirt now? I hear Mom and stepdad yelling from the house. I remember that worms can't hear, but that they can feel vibrations. I try to push the worms, tell them to go, that it's no good here. I get mad when they just curl up on themselves and wriggle. I start to cry. Mom yells at me from the doorway, tells me to get my ass back inside. I kick the rusted deep freeze on the porch and cry harder. I let the screen door slam behind me. The next day, Mom says it's okay if I go out to play. I guess her and stepdad made up because he's pinching her elbow and kissing her cheek when she tells me. She has to push him off of her a little bit, but she's giggling. I want to tell the worms that it isn't always going to stay good. But they're not by the truck cover. I put my face close to the dirt to make sure, and they're not by the water hose either, or under the pile of roof shingles. They listened to me. They left. I don't know where they went, but they got out of here. I jump up and down and around in the empty puddles. When I get dizzy and out of breath, I sit down where they used to be. I wait for the world to straighten back out and think about yesterday, tomorrow. I wish I could have gone with them. Magpie. Mom is sick again. Withdraw. Judge Judy screams from the TV in the back bedroom. I'm beside the kerosene heater, sitting Indian style in front of the TV, running my hands through the dust and dirt of the living room carpet. It's summer break. Our fridge is empty. I know better than to ask Mom about it. My eyes strain, fixed on a cartoon magpie looming by a tree, waiting for a swallow's egg to hatch. The show's in black and white, and the music slides from high to low. The magpie licks its beak. My stomach pangs, and I shiver, then sweat. The swallow squawks to life, and the magpie swoops down. I'm scared to look. I turn the TV off. I check the kitchen again. Bills are stuffed in the bread box. There are dishes piled up in the sink, and I think to check there for a scrap. But then I remember the Crisco in the back of the pantry. I open the tub and find crumbs from where I dipped stale bread. I scoop them out with three fingers and suck on them. My stomach feels queasy. I like school because of the lunch lady, the one who gave me the bread on the last day before summer, the one who always gives me seconds. She sent me home with everything she could find, milk, fruit, hot dog buns, foil-wrapped potatoes. I snuck them in my pockets so the other kids wouldn't see. I think about what I would like to eat, my favorite school lunches, oven-baked chicken and rice, ham and cheese on a bagel, mashed potatoes, meatball sandwiches, French fries. The TV blares from Mom's room. It's not all about you. I feel like Judge Judy is screaming at me this time. But she's right. Mom says that food isn't cheap. I think of all the money we're saving. I go to the bathroom, turn on the light, look in the mirror, and lift up my shirt. I trace my fingers along my ribs like stepdad does. He says it's like counting the dollars in the bank account. I feel like I'm doing real good when I see how white my skin is. But I don't feel real good. It started to itch on the inside where my fingers couldn't reach. Then it turned into pain, like the time I got hit with the dodgeball during gym class. Like somebody squishing my stomach with their hands without ever letting go. Through the open bathroom door, I smell a hamburger cooking far off. I wonder if the neighbor kid has to give his stepdad his rib dollars. Probably not. The wind pushes more hamburger smell through the window, and the back of my tongue prickles. Drool fills my cheeks. My head feels empty. I make a fist and punch my gut, a trick I do to feel full. It doesn't work. I gnaw at the air and punch the shower curtain. I wonder if this is how Mom feels. Last night, she got in bed with her shoes on. She hasn't come out yet. The clock says it's 3:33. She doesn't come out until 8:50, when I'm gulping water from the tap. I look up and wipe my mouth. She's in a shiny pink robe with cigarette holes around the hem, and her hair is mousy and knotted. She doesn't look at me. She puts a cast iron skillet on the gas stove and lights the burner. She opens the fridge and stands silhouetted in its light. She turns around and asks me, "When is Vern coming home?" I tell her stepdad is gone this weekend. Fishing, remember? I imagine the magpie zooming around my head. He settles on my shoulder and uses his wings to point to a mirage of a little boat on water. He tells me Vern's out there, and how to hook him, and how to clean him, and how to cook him, and how to eat him. But I can't. I let Magpie have him. He swoops down on the boat and pecks Vern till his arms stop flapping and eats him up. This time, I even watch. You always remember, Arnie baby. Mom's voice sinks the boat. She turns and smiles, but it doesn't touch her eyes. They stay far away and glassy. She nods her head a second too late, a cigarette bobbing between her lips. She closes the fridge empty-handed and goes back to the stove. She tosses the hot skillet forward and backward, keeping her eyes on the wall in front of her. After a few minutes, she shuffles down the hallway back to her bedroom. I wonder if she'll ever come back. I turn the burner off. I'm not hungry anymore. Jesus, a junk drawer. Lately, Mom has been into watching this televangelist, Benny A. Meyer, out of Charlotte. It's all suits, big hair, white teeth, tan skin, and fake plants. A phone number and words scroll across the bottom of the screen. If you call that number, you can get saved for only $14.95. Jesus said, I'm the light of the world. I'm the light of life. There are no shadows with Jesus around, no sir, no ma'am, and that, my friends, is bad news. Because the shadows are where things get hidden, forgotten, scavenged away. But it's all good news, very good news, because if Jesus is the light, that means that he finds the hidden, forgotten, and scavenged away things. If you let Jesus in your shadows, he will come and save and heal and bless. I've been picking things out of the couch cushions because I don't get any rib money. I have $3.68, 4 potato chips, some cigarette butts, a clump of hair I must have cut out when I was a kid, chicken wing bones, a tube of lipstick, and a lot of crumbs, but not enough to get saved. The good book tells us that if we want to receive God's blessing, if we want to feel closer to the Almighty, then we must be like little children. And what do children do? They trust. They know that God has power over their lives, but they don't give up. They trust that every little thing will be okay. Jesus was rich, and Jesus wants us to be rich. God blessed Abraham with riches, blessed him with silver and gold. How many of you like silver and gold? The crowd sways with their palms pressed upward toward the ceiling. Reverend Meyer, we like silver and gold. Your sins have to pop out somewhere. Little children have acne. Why? I can tell you why. What little boys do in the bedroom at night. It's a natural process of the fallen creature, what he does in the bedroom at night. You tie his hands, won't do any good. Tie them all you want. It's in their nature, it's in their fallen nature what they do in the bedroom at night. That's why acne's on these young people's faces. That's what they do. I scratch at the pimples on my cheeks. Would he really save me? After the Reverend Meyer show, there's always a commercial that runs for a junk drawer organizer. I ask Mom, what's a junk drawer? She tells me it's where you put all that shit you don't want. I wonder what it would be like to have Jesus, a junk drawer. Mom changes her answer, says I'm the junk drawer. Thank you.
Okay, next up is David Frame, poetry, and I have Natalie Homer's introduction here. David Frame's collection, Pilgrim, revolves around a speaker who is highly self-aware and whose awareness causes him to question his reality. These poems are cleverly superimposed under the structure of the Divine Comedy. In the first section, Inferno is portrayed as a modern-day rave. The poems in this section are vibrant and energetic with dreamlike images, colors, people, and sound play. The second section, Purgatorio, is a quieter section that is about finding growth in suffering, discomfort, and achieving the stillness and satisfaction of Paradiso. The third section, Paradiso, melts into a Whitman-esque exploration of nature and satisfaction, Throughout the sections, Frame is able to deftly change tone, even within the same poem, from one of jaded experience to questioning innocence. Sometimes the reader is wrapped up in a trance-like state, while other times readers are brought back down to earth in flashes of lucidity. Pilgrim explores what it means to be human from three distinct angles, yet also blurs these categories and challenges the notion of internal separation. Please help me in welcoming David Frame.
I'm just going to be reading from the first section here.
David, a little louder.
I'm reading from the first section. It's titled Pilgrim, A Poet's Guide to Fitting In. Canto 1, Your Faithful Correspondent. I've returned with news from the underbelly. I've been sleepwalking through this country, rolling among the shag rugs and smoky futons, for nigh on a decade and dreaming. Pilgrim and suburban ambassador to the hidden hillsides, neon mountains, electric forests. I've been flapping flightless around dim apartments, making money for things I smoke and swallow, away and gone, sustained by some Sisyphean supposed pleasures. Sitting silent in the corner, longing to slip into some lofty current of belonging, imagining to myself what people might say who've things to talk about, the flourish of calligraphy flitting off every corner, while I'm in the rooms of the normal comings and goings, when all I have to say is I'm afraid. Canto 2, The Buffalo. Today I'm taking off, flying over Rothbury, Michigan. At least I'm in the air, high above the tall grass prairies, someplace where the buffalo roamed. I'm trying my best to ditch myself in the currents and canticles of the new age and be the kind of free that people pay to be, but never moving forward, so not flying, just up here. Not hanging, not weightless, more like a force compels me skyward. More like buoyancy, bubbling, boiling, high up here above the buffalo, the undulating herd. Many bulging black-eyed faces becoming the faceless whole, I realize then I'm sinking slowly towards them. I realize I'm not floating, I'm swimming, and I have to tread hard and fast to stay here above the buffalo, over the tall grass prairies. Canto 3, The Cost of Freedom. At Electric Forest, three things unite us all: the desire to shed an oppressive consumer culture, the need to forget ourselves, and $350 plus tax. Expenses not included, the cost of travel, 5 cases of beer, 3 days rations, camp stove, spray-on SPF 50 sunblock, sustainable brand hammock, bedding, Marquee Regent testing kit, additional $100 party favor allowance, refillable water bladder with hose, $10 per shower. You will want one. Everyone from the lowliest lawyer's son to the most disowned daughter of distraught stockbrokers and middle-class mamas watching their babies flee to fight for the plight of the proletariat. For the relative cost of a New York apartment, you too can have 3 days of all the equality money can buy. Canto 4, Cutco and Avon. I see him in his sandaled feet, sharp dressed in the suit of his generation, cargo shorts and cutoff tee, slinging a red backpack, the millennial briefcase, over his shoulder. Tent by tent, he carries his wares. She's close behind, all high socks and glow stick glasses, peering over a giant sucker. Brother Cutco and Sister Avon, using buzzwords, creating an in-group. Kitty, Sass, Molly, Lucy, Roland, Trippin', Candy Flippin'. He promises they come sharp and stay sharp. She offers to make us feel fresh, clean, beautiful. But can she make me forget my face? Would some more stable alloy satisfy my need? And are they making marks with a salesman's smile, or have they embraced the therein come, with this evangelist's zeal that reels me in, wriggling. Canto 5, The Womb. While walking through, I shit you not, Sherwood Forest, I am overcome by the painstakingly induced reverie of spectacle, of mist and light in sweeping hues, roiling like an ocean heaved by lunar masses and surging, churning, rushing again outward and into shifting tree lines, alight with two small hot air balloons, casting their own crescendos of color. The floor writhing with fleshy bodies and even knees so bright, my soul should surely have left its host. But mostly it made it hard to see, discouraging any eye from meeting except in fleeting flashes. And as the light recedes, another lulls me in, suffuse and subtle blue to, I shit you not, the womb. Actors painted sallow silver, wearing Greek tunics with laurel wreaths, chanting Hindi at a whisper and droning on a Chinese gong, they swoop and swoon like predatory birds over young philosophers who have only just sipped from the Pierian stream, weaving dreams, but mostly only making a scene, enticing others without gleaning understanding glances. Canto 6, Free Love. She's trapped here, I thought, in the lonely glimpse I stole as we strolled by the triage golf cart and mounted cavalry. Eyes wide and flat as saucers, irises a thin rim, blue as glacial waters wrapped around a black as deep as wells in which a little girl may find she fell, having leaned too far to hear some echo of herself. Still her hair was a too tight crown of curls, and curled lips let slip a laugh. You don't understand, I just want to dance. She had nothing to hide behind or inside but a braided leather thong on her forehead, meant to hold her curls, now over her eyes, her thin, muddy hands clutching bright, ruddy thighs. Canto 7, Gomorrah. All girls a go-go in Gomorrah, eyes can't hide a gaze at graceful oceans and how blissful, unaware of tender motion all around, of slender thighs all slipping by the thousands, monoliths of pure sound pumping like a great black heart, a tempest of body that burns the day, I turn away, afraid to be made a pillar of salt.
Next up is Zach Boyle, and Zach's mentor is Bryce Berkowitz, who has a class, so I'm reading his introduction. Zach Boyle is a graduating senior from Philadelphia. His major is creative writing with a concentration in fiction. He kicked off his writing and publishing career at an early age. In seventh grade, he wrote a poem about geology called Rocks of Fire, which his teacher published in the school literary magazine. His final capstone project, entitled Closed, features a well-organized first-person narrative told non-linearly about a family struggling to understand the unraveling, disappearance, and eventual death of their mother. Please put your hands together for Zach Boyle.
Kevin, I'm going to be reading three specific sections from my piece. The house I grew up in smelled thick of dust, settling into a room after a much-needed vacuum has worked its way through. Not that my house was old or abandoned, there just weren't as many people to take care of it anymore. I put my bags down on my white carpet bedroom floor. My room would usually be cold for an October night, but someone knew to put the heat on, whereas my father would mostly say, "You're not paying the bills." I stayed in my old room. I was the first one of my brothers to get my own room. My parents kept my old dark blue paint on the walls, ignoring the peeling wallpaper of race car drivers. I remember when I put Pokemon stickers over the black number 8 car to cover a hole I made when I was wrestling in my room. I sat on my old grade school bed, too short to cover my knees, and open the nightstand I used to stash bad grades and swimsuit catalogs. A crumpled envelope that had been stretched flat again sat on top of my old magazines. I took a pen from my desk and broke the seal of the envelope. It was addressed to my older brother, Joe. My psychiatrist told me that writing out how I feel about all the causes of stress in my life will make it easier to handle. You make my your father and I fight every night because we don't agree on how to handle you. I remember when your 8th grade teacher told you that you didn't deserve to be at a prep school, and she was right. You have wasted our money and have put a separation between your father and I. I hate you for that. You did this. You are no son of mine. You are selfish and undeserving. I put the paper back, closed the envelope, and put the letter back in the drawer. It had Joseph written in blue cursive across the front of the envelope. The letters faded from view as I slid the drawer back into its place. Are you coming down? Joe's voice echoed from the bottom of the stairs. Yeah, be there in a minute. I heard the rhythmic beat of his feet hitting 2 steps at a time on his way to the basement. I walked out of my old room into the basement door. Need a beer? I said from the top of the stairs on my way down. Joe swirled a brown beer bottle by its neck from the couch. Yeah, I'll take a guy. I walked to the newly added fridge, silver and shimmering, and picked out a lion's head beer. The paper label was wet with perspiration. I grabbed 2 and peeled the label off my brother's beer with my thumbnail as I walked over and placed it on the table in front of him. His eyes were fixed on the local hockey game. He didn't notice I had torn off the label and never asked about it. How's the new job? I asked, sitting on the couch opposite Joe. Joe swigged the bottle, tilting it skyward by the neck, moving just 2 fingers while his eyes fixated on the game. A commercial came on and Joe sat back, placing a forearm behind his head. It's really good, Joe smiled and looked at part of the bottle where I'd torn off the label. I really like it so far. Hey, cheers to that. We punched our bottles together and made our beers foam. What are you doing for them right now? Mostly just learning how insurance works, being an underwriter, working with policy issuance, all that. I have to get my certifications before I get full-time. That's really awesome. Congrats. Joe twisted the bottle so the torn label was facing towards me. Thanks. He took a quick sip from the bottle. I heard the strong steps of my younger brother move across the ceiling as he moved through the kitchen and towards the basement door. What's up, boys? He said, moving fast down the stairs. Joe turned his head and hung his right hand above his head. Grant walked around the couch and grabbed a beer from the fridge. So what's our plan tonight, boys? Grant asked, taking his sleeve and wiping out a beer mug he kept in the basement. I don't know, man. I know what we're doing. Steph's, Grant spoke confidently. Joe laughed and looked back at his half-empty bottle. No way, buddy. Some of us have to get up in the morning. Come on. Eric doesn't come home a lot. Let's go out. It's all good, man. Let's just do drinks here, I said. Nah, no way, man. We're getting out there. Gonna get all kinds of sliced. Well, I'd rather just hang out with the bros tonight, honestly. If Joe can't go out, we can just do it on the weekend when he's off. Fine, but if we're gonna stay in, we're gonna need more beer. Grant said, walking to the fridge, returning with 2 rounds for each of us. It was the first time being home all year after being away at college. Joe had left early for work in the morning, but the dozens of empty bottles littered the basement table from the night before. Grant had left for practice with his tennis team. I was the only one in the family that didn't inherit the athletic ability that landed both my brother's college scholarships. I cleaned the basement and sat on the couch when I was done. The couch was taken from our neighbor's trash one night. Its cushions were beaten and stained. They were noticeable because of one of the white gray color of the couch. The basement was cold. It was a finished basement in the sense that instead of a concrete floor that I had grown up walking on, there was now a gray carpet that was thin and hard. We moved our old TV down there when my father came home with a new flat screen one afternoon. Joe brought down an old futon he used for school and found a couch in the storage that was green and slimy like Jersey Shore seaweed. Centered in between the 3 couches was an old wooden table that has since had its legs spray painted black, but its top was still the worn down brown that looked a lot better when I was a kid racing my cars across the table while my mom made dinner. My father got us the fridge while I was away at school one winter. The first time I came home and saw it, he had stocked it with as much light beer as it would fit. The only reason we were allowed to drink as much as we do in the house is because Joe pioneered the way. Eventually, my father realized it was the inevitability of having 3 boys only being a few years apart. He figured it was better to have three drunk sons under one roof versus three drunk sons in three different places. My mom was never a big fan of drinking or loud noises. I walked through the house for a little while that morning. I stopped at each picture hanging on the wall and forced myself to remember what I could from each moment. The first picture was taken in Hilton Head, North Carolina. My mother was crouched with my father. Behind them was a crisp green garden with soft pink flower buds poking through the brush. Our family dog, Dutch, was fat and panting in the North Carolina heat. I don't remember much else about that trip. Next, I stopped at the wall of Joe. His graduation picture was slightly unaligned in a frame, and under that picture was a picture of him in eighth grade playing basketball. My father coached all of us, but Joe's team was the best. I walked past my pictures and into my father's office. He had pictures from the early 90s when he was still relatively young. In the top corner of his polished wood bookshelf, he kept a picture of my mother when she was barely 23. The first year my father met my mother, she gave him the picture. The frame was a bright gold that was fading from sitting in the sun year after year. The top of the frame collected sticky dust. My mother's gaze was off to the left in the picture. Her hair was typical 80s style, large and messy. Her face looked porcelain and fragile. The picture cut off at her shoulders, but she wore a red jacket with gold lace and buttons. I cannot remember the context of the picture. I wasn't alive at the time. I guess I existed in the picture simply as an idea or future. Looking at the picture of her, I began to remember her telling me stories about her foster homes growing up. I remember her telling me about each time she was adopted, and how each story had a similar arc of acceptance and later betrayal. One day I was helping my mother in the kitchen with dinner. The TV was playing from the other room, and every now and then my mother would bop me on the head so I would stop watching TV and help roll croissants. "So did you have a lot of brothers and sisters?" "Oh yeah, I had a family bigger than your father's." I laughed as my small child fingers reached across the island to place the croissant on the aluminum tray. "How many states have you lived in?" "Oh, quite a few, probably close to 10 states. But you like Texas the most, right?" "Exactly." "Do you remember anything about your mom?" "Not really. I was a baby when I was an orphan." "Not anything?" My mother stopped rolling and placed her hands on the edge of the island and breathed. "You know you don't ever have to worry about that." "About what?" "Not knowing me. I'll always be in your life. Always. Your brothers, too." "I know, Mom. You know you three are the only biological connection I have on this earth. You, Joe, Grant. That's it." "We know, Mom. You're my beautiful boys." She brushed my hair with her hand, covered in flour and dough. "Mom, quit it." I laughed and rolled my head up from under her hand. She started rolling croissants again. "Okay. Put these in the oven and set the timer. 7 minutes on 350. I looked away from the picture of my mother and continued down the row of shelves in my father's office. I don't know why he keeps this picture around. The doctor opened the silver door and pulled out a long tray with a baby blue sheet covering what was supposedly my mother. "Pull it back." When the sheet was lifted, my mother's eyes were closed and her face was blue from the cold. Mom never liked the cold. She was raised in the South. She loved Texas. "Don't worry. I'll be careful and make sure that all the covers are marked," the mortician said, looking down at my mother. I turned away from Mom and the doctor pushed the tray back in. I heard the door lock in place when he shut it. I put my name on the sign-in sheet at the doctor's desk and left to meet my brothers, who were waiting around the corner. On my walk back to meet my brothers, I thought about Mom's face, how it would smile when she picked me up from school when I felt sick. "What do you want to do first?" she would always ask. She would take me to the grocery store by our house and buy me gummies and Hank's root beer in a bottle. It made me feel like my dad drinking out of brown bottles. I cleared my head when I saw the pizza shop my brothers were at. They didn't remember our childhood so much as the later years. "So," my brother said as I walked into the store, "it was her. I signed for her body to be released to us. The mortician said she'll be ready for the funeral in the week." We fell silent and my younger brother spun a plastic knife on the table. "Has anyone told Dad yet?" Grant said, sitting to my left. "I will," I said, blowing my nose. "Okay, I'll help cover the cost for whatever we need," Joe spoke softly. "I thought you didn't really want to get too involved." "She's still my mother," he said with a firm tone.
I'm going to take off then. I want to go tell Dad before he hears from anyone else. How long had it been, Grant asked as I got up from the table, since any one of us had talked to her. 8 years, Joe spoke, looking at his phone. 8 years yesterday. I pushed my arm through the jacket and told my brothers I'd call them later, after I had spoken with Dad. The morning was warm. The frost of the grass was melting into dew and the orange sun coming over the church. I stood with my brothers at the front of the steps and greeted relatives, friends, neighbors, and more people I didn't know or remember how I knew. Each one gave their condolences and some gave hugs. Ms. Michaels gave me a rub on my shoulder. I thought about giving a speech during the Mass. I watched sisters and cousins tell stories about her. They talked about her happy personality, the way she lit up the room when she walked in. They talked and I thought about how I knew her. She had been gone since I was in high school, and I'm 25 now. I didn't know her. I hadn't spoken to her since I told her about who I was taking to the December homecoming dance. What would she know about me? She doesn't know where I went to college, or what I do for a living, what Joe does for a living. She's never even seen Grant win a college tennis match.